That's just a good party, man. Yeah, I can dig it.
Stop. Right on.
Good morning and welcome to the Early Root Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number, and it's Friday. That means Friday's with my co-host, none other than Sandy Williams. Hey, Sandy, how you doing, man?
All right. Friday.
Yeah, you know
it's almost another Packer game. Well, it's actually Monday night this week, so.
No, it's Sunday night.
Is it right? Sunday night?
Yeah, Sunday night. Well, you don't know. It doesn't matter whether it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday for you.
Every day's Saturday.
I know. You know, that's a great place to get to, right? You think about how many hours you used to work, right?
Absolutely.
Oh, I forgot. Good morning, Connor. How you doing, man?
I'm doing all right, Earl.
All right. It's good to see you, man. You know, Sandy, that's a good place to get to.
Saturday.
Yeah,
permanent Saturday.
Yeah.
Everlasting Saturday.
You think about, man, all those years, all those hours you put in to get to where you are. And I know you enjoyed the work you did, right?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I think some people are made that way. I enjoyed working. I think I would have enjoyed anything that required me to work hard. Maybe it's because you can't think about everything else while you're working.
You know, so is retirement everything you thought it was going to be?
You know, I didn't preconceive retirement. I was kind of afraid of retirement because, like you said, I really enjoyed work, and I think I identified myself through my work. So I was fearful about retiring. And so has it been everything? Oh, it's been much better than I thought it would be because I was afraid of the process. And I've been coaching rowing. I've been doing this radio.
Yeah.
I've been doing this other stuff that's really demonstrated to me that there's a lot to life outside of work.
You know, did you retire young?
Well, young's relevant. I was 68.
Oh, no. You certainly. There are people. I know guys who retired at 48.
Well, I knew some guys who were in the law firm who retired when they were 27. They just didn't stop coming to the office.
Oh. I mean, I knew guys that I worked with. We had 30 and out. And so guys retired at 48.
After 30 years.
Yeah, after 30 years.
Wow,
and never did anything else. And I said, some of them expired kind of young. And I used to ask them, man, what do you? I'd see them maybe 10 years later, man. What are you doing, man? I worked 30 years. I'm done.
Huh.
You know, I'm retired, and I just think that, like, for me, retirement is not something.
I think retirement allows you to go off and do the work that you really want to do, but not stop working. You know, I know some guys play golf every day. To me, that would be golf every day.
Yeah.
And about the fifth day, it'd be like, well, I got another round of golf. Pretty soon, golf becomes work.
You know, people say, well, you're doing radio, man. Isn't that work? I said, come on, man. If this was work, Sandy,
mm-hmm.
You know, if I had to, you know, 8 hours, 5 days a week, and I've had to, you know, do the same tedious things that, you know, I mean, you come in, you do, this is not work.
Well, yeah, no, it's not right. I mean, you know, if we'd all had the opportunity to absolutely just do exactly what we love doing, which is what some young people today actually have either the luxury or the luck of finding. You know, they figure out, I love doing this, and then they head off and they do it for their occupation, for their life. And for them, occupation isn't work. It's pursuing every day the thing that captures their interest.
Right.
And so, you know, people, some people are lucky, and they get they figure out early enough in their life what it is they're fascinated with, what captures their interest, and they end up doing it. And those people are successful by definition because, number one, they love what they're doing. So they're successful just because of that. But I think most people who love what they're doing end up doing it very, very well and end up being successful as measured by other people as well.
You know, Sandy, you just read my mind. Maybe it's that easy to read because I was going to ask how fortunate people are to find out what they love doing, and the earlier in life they find it,
yeah,
the more happy they are in life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I coach and I do this radio stuff, and I love it. You know, I this is not work, and you know,
coaching is not work.
No,
right?
Coaching isn't work. It's totally satisfying. I'm getting as much from it as I'm putting into it, and I think that a lot of people, you know, many people, discover this and end up pursuing this. You know, I think and it affords them the opportunity to be successful by their own definition, which is doing something every day that pleases them, and then also typically people who love what they're doing, I think, do it very well, use their imagination. They usually change the way this thing that they love doing is done. You know, I think some of the geniuses in our world who have changed the landscape have done it because they fell into doing something they love doing.
You know, Sandy, that involvement in athletics with young people feeds something in us that I think sometimes, you know, others could do. And maybe not realize, mm-hmm. You know, once their children are grown, and, you know, and certainly you have your grandchildren, but the need for mentoring young boys is endless. And I don't care if they're young boys who live in suburbs or whether they're young boys who live in rural areas and urban areas, what they are all looking for. Is a relationship with men, and you and I know this. It's we can't reach our own children at times, and so I know I've
well. Children come with the baggage. You know, part of nature is that children are supposed to break from their parents and go off on their own. And I just saw Barack Obama being quoted about raising kids, and you know, he said, you know, the most successful parents are the ones who teach their children to be independent from their parents, and that is the outcome that nature requires for kids to turn into successful adults, is they have to free themselves from dependency on their parents. And part of that is, I suspect, getting an abrasive relationship that they need to break off with their parents. And you don't have that when you're dealing with other people's children. and when you're coaching. But the other thing about coaching is, I think it's less about athletics and more about having this shared mutual interest with the kid, in which you're able to channel to the kid and have a contact with him because you're both talking about something else.
Right.
You're talking about football. I talk about rowing, and the kids are many of them are intensely interested in getting your advice about this thing they want to do better.
You know, your point is so valid because we're not talking about, hey, you didn't get your room clean. Hey, your friends, I got a problem with the guys you're hanging out with, right? And certainly your grades aren't what they should be. And you've got to do this and you've got to do that. And so your children look at that.
Yeah.
And they can't get past us, you know, trying to give them these directives that long term are going to be beneficial to them. They can't see it in their developing stages. And then when we're around other people's children, we're talking to them about, you know, these things to improve their lives and things that that maybe, you know, their own parents are having trouble because they're experiencing the exact same thing you and I are experiencing.
Well, like I said, when you're either maybe in school, teachers have a little bit. They're sort of halfway between a coach and a parent because they've got to circumscribe right. the kid's behavior, and they're sort of in the, and when you're doing coaching, the kid has shown up on his own, or maybe he's been encouraged by his parents. But if you've bitten into them enough to get their interest and they want to do it, then you're working together. To get a shared interest accomplished. And, you know, I think that's what good coaches do. I think there are some coaches who think they're Vince Lombardi.
Yep.
who think that beating the kid over the head, you know, and challenging him and being this kind of coercive force in there. And who knows? Maybe some children, some young athletes want that like that. But anyway, I think that coaching or doing this radio, or there are other things that people do that you know, you can fall in love with what you do, and if you do, God bless you. That's just the best possible outcome.
You've got to find something in your life mm-hmm. that you enjoy and love doing, and everybody has talents. And it's unfortunate, Sandy, that in many people's lives, they go through their entire lives without ever discovering what their talents are.
Well, you know, some of it has to do with the work ethic. You know, like I said earlier, I do like working hard, and to some extent that has masked from me the notion that I could work hard at something that I actually love doing yeah. instead of just loving working. And to some extent, middle-class America was put in the position of needing to love working because, you know, it wasn't fun to go to work in a foundry and hit something over the head this, you know, the same way every day and maybe get better and better at hitting it more directly. You know, that isn't something you fall in love with, but if you can get to the point where you really enjoy working hard, and you do have colleagues. There is that other part of work, which is if you don't love what you're doing, you at least have this family at work of people who are doing the same thing you are and maybe have the same ethics. So, you know, Henry Ford started this process. You don't have to love what you do, but you can like the money that you take home, and you can work hard. And so that's what the assembly line became, because nobody loved working on an assembly line unless they just loved working.
You know, Sandy, talking about finding things that you love doing, we also share a love of cooking.
Well, you know, you said before the show, now you've got some competition. You said that you won like the Top Chef Award or some, you know.
Two years in a row. Yeah, let's see. This is 2022.
Now, these are people who had COVID and had lost their sense of taste and smell.
Come on, man.
Yeah, that's pretty harsh.
You know?
That's a COVID convention. People, yes, they didn't even know if they were eating. What they were eating.
You know, I didn't. I'm trying to remember when and where I got to a point in my life where I started cooking and enjoyed cooking. And it wasn't something that when I was young.
So your wife had read Tom Sawyer. And the part about they're having so much fun painting the fence white. Earl, why don't you try this fence paint? It's fun. And then you moved into the kitchen.
Well, you know what it was? Cable television and watching great chefs.
Ah, like that guy from New Orleans?
Yeah, actually.
What was his name?
The really big guy?
Well, the guy.
There were so many of them.
The guy that had the Cajun accent, and he could teach you how to do all this
New Orleans
cooking.
Were so many different ones over the years. I still, you know, Bobby Flay.
Yeah,
I'm still a big Bobby Flay fan, and anytime I get the chance to see Bobby Flay,
well, he was one of the guys on Top Chef, wasn't he?
One of the
judges, yeah,
yeah. And I always say, as I watch that, I wonder what that food tastes like. Right, these great chefs. There was the guy who I used to just love watching, and he traveled all over the world.
Oh, Anthony Bourdain?
Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
Anthony Bourdain. Yeah. Well, we got a lot in common. So I could watch Anthony Bourdain from sunup to sundown, personality.
Well, you know, he had a very interesting life, but pre-chef, you know. Yeah, he went through a whole lot of personal. Yeah, I mean, he was a troubled person, and unfortunately, ultimately, he took his own life. But he was a fantastic guy.
Yeah, he really, truly was, and made a fortune, lost a fortune, and it just.
Well, he combined two things, you know, traveling and cooking. You know, his show was all about traveling all over the world and eating strange things and cooking.
And there's another guy, Zimmerman.
Yeah, he's the guy that just eats strange stuff.
So, man, we've got a lot in common.
Yeah. Well, I do like cooking, and you obviously are a really good chef.
Now, speaking of a good chef, you're a great cook. And so I always tell people, they say, well... And I always say, if I'm going to cook, leave me alone. I'm not getting no phone calls, none of those things. You have to focus on what it is you're doing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think both of us.
So hold the thought.
We could have cooked as for livings and loved it, you know?
Yeah, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. We'll be back. So my thing is, that's Prince, man. Yeah, I was listening. Come on, man. You know, I was,
fingerprints.
welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Fridays. My co-host, Sandy Williams, is in the studio. We're talking about, believe it or not, and cooking. Look, the one thing that you should know about Sandy and I is we'll be talking about any and everything. You know, because we're not quite Renaissance men, but we're Sandy's a Renaissance man.
I was born in the Renaissance.
but we were talking about I think I remember the
chef,
yeah, Perdomo.
No, Anthony Bourdain.
No, the guy from Perdomo, the guy from New Orleans.
Oh,
there was a guy who weighed about 400 pounds.
The guy I'm thinking about ended up coming out with a whole line of
Yeah, you're talking about he's still around.
He's still around.
Yeah, he's making a lot of money.
Yeah,
and
selling knives and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, and cooking
stuff that'll kill you.
Yeah. Dry, you know, cooking without oil and those kind of things. What is his name? Anyway, it'll come to me. But the thing about cooking is that I've always enjoyed, since I've gotten into it, man, is, you know, just the preparation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got started yesterday on this, you know. You know, and because, you know, normally I would do it the day of, the morning of. This competition is on Saturday morning. And so I would get up early in the morning on Saturday, 5 o'clock, and do all that stuff. But by then, you're just burnt out. And by the time you get to the competition, you know, it's you know, you're not as, you know, hyped. I did those last couple years that I won. Guess what? I broadcast live from the competition. I did my radio show from the competition.
Really? While you were cooking?
I had already prepared the food.
Ah, okay.
And then I let somebody else do
it. Because we're cooking right now.
Yeah.
we're smoking.
Again, men, I don't know if it's coincidental, Sandy, but is a coincidence that the greatest chefs are men?
Well, I think only because men end up being having a dominant position in society based on...
Do you think that's what it is, really?
Oh, yeah, because now women are increasingly becoming really good chefs, and they're becoming more prominent. But I think it was really chauvinism. I think it was societal chauvinism.
What? Yeah, I mean, all the good cooks in my life were women, so I don't...
Listen, man. Sandy, you traveled.
It's the opportunity to be a professional chef.
Sandy, you traveled the world.
Yeah.
And in those places. And in those places, at the great restaurants, the chefs are men.
Look, so are the CEOs. No. So are the CEOs of the major companies. Come on, let's call a spade a spade.
Sandy, you're exposing me.
Yeah, well, this is a blind spot. Right?
Connor's having a conniption in there with what you just said.
Well, I think it might be a blind spot.
Really?
I'm
not saying women can't cook.
It's the same. Well, now we can revert to something much more profound. Your inability to see that is the same as I think lots of people's inability to see their own racism. They will reach conclusions about what they're seeing that are just based on the coincidence of what they're seeing. You know, the chefs they see are all men, i.e., men are the best cooks. No.
Is that what I said?
No, not really.
Oh,
but you said, but you said men are all the best, you know, the great chefs are all men. That sort of suggests that somehow men have a greater capacity to be chefs than women do, and they don't. They just have a greater opportunity to become professional chefs, because that's the way the world has operated.
Well, I will retract that, because I really don't know that to be a fact.
Well, okay. It is a fact, and I think, you know, there has been a fair movement in the last 20 years to try and correct that. But no, it's true that most of the great restaurants and most of the famous chefs have male chefs.
So what was the first back in the days when your father bought the first 7-inch television?
Breda Green.
No, it wasn't her.
Remember her? No, Breda Green was on WTMJ, and she was a woman who taught cooking, and on TV. Breda Green.
I'm talking about on Channel 10. This woman was around for...
Oh, Julia Childs.
Julia Childs.
Oh, I had the opportunity and went to a cooking, little one of these cooking school things in Julia Childs' house.
Really?
In near Nice, France. But she was already deceased. But it was a house that she had with her husband, Jules, and someone had bought it, and they continued teaching cooking in the place. Yeah.
And you went to one of the training.
Yeah. It was like a 3-day thing.
Well, I told you, Sandy.
You just paid a bunch of money to do it.
Come on, man. Come on. He goes and he sees Julia Child's course in cooking. And instead of reading it in a book,
I can even cross over with Julia Child's one other way. I was in Paris staying in the Hotel Lutetia, and at the same time I was there,
are you hearing this?
They were filming.
Are you hearing this?
They were filming movie Jules and Julia, and Meryl Streep and the whole cast was there, and there they were in the same hotel dining area. So I go out to walk around Paris that day, and I come upon a film set, and they're filming this thing, and she's buying fish.
We've got to go to break.
That's enough of the story.
844-967-2789. We'll be back.
It wasn't pretty interesting.
All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Sandy, that sounds like... Did you request that?
I wasn't listening to music. I was thinking.
Yeah, I was... Because that sounds like something that was around when you were probably about 16 years old. What is that, man?
No, it's actually Jack White.
Who's Jack White?
Jack White, so the White Stripes, the 2000s rock band. Famous for their song Seven Nation Army. It's like a soccer channel across the world.
Let little that play. Let's see if Sandy would think that this would.
Spin around and your feet run cold. I got fever.
Oh, I do like it.
Yeah, fever, yeah, I'm fun for sure. I feel like I've been run right through the mill. And I can't move around and I can't stand still. I'm Bo Diddley.
Bo Diddley.
Bo Diddley. He's from that vintage. About 8th grade.
Bo Diddley. Yeah, you know, I believe it or not, I know who Bo Diddley was.
Yeah.
And remember hearing a little Bo Diddley. If I know and remember.
Bo Diddley and Fats Domino, they were the same vintage.
So if I remember Fats Domino and Bo Diddley, what does that make me?
Well, it makes you pretty old.
It makes you knowledgeable about music. That's what it makes you.
All right, all right. So
why you gotta dig at Earl so hard, Sandy?
Listen. Well, listen.
You have to be part of this is merciless banter.
Yeah. No, I know. It's just funny.
Man, listen, Sandy. This is a story that is not funny. And
but it's a good segue from old. You're going to talk about.
Yes.
I think you're going to talk about. Yeah,
it is, Sandy. And man, you just have been so right about our lack of planning. And this is in today's The Hill in healthcare. America's age tipping point is approaching. We're totally unprepared. Let me just read a couple paragraphs. America faces mounting old age challenges as growing numbers of individuals find themselves ill-prepared in terms of financial resources, personal health, and social support for their remaining years of life. The number of Americans aged 65 and older has increased to approximately 56 million, I'm one of them, or 17% of the population, nearly double the 1960 level of 9%. The majority, about 55%, are women, and among those 85 and older, nearly two-thirds are women. In 2030, America will experience a demographic turning point when all baby boomers will be older than 65. That's only 8 years from now. That will equal one out of five Americans. Also importantly, by 2034, those older than 65 are expected to outnumber children for the first time in U.S. history. Let me get this quickly. With respect to financial resources, the median annual income of older Americans is approximately $28,000 for men and $22,000 for women. Also, nearly 10% live below the poverty level. This also varies according to racial ethnicity.
That's a really hard word to say.
Yeah.
Ethnicity.
Ethnic. Ethnic.
Yeah.
Ethnic. Demographers, with black and Hispanic Americans having the highest percentages living below the poverty level at 18 and 17%, respectively. Asian and white Americans are at approximately half those levels, 9 and 7%. Respectively. Last thing. According to the U.S. Government Accountability Office, nearly half of American households headed by someone 55 years and older lack some form of retirement savings. It also reports that close to 30% of those who are retired or nearing retirement do not have retirement savings or defined benefit plans. Sandy, I ask you, this is a catastrophe.
Well, it certainly is a potential catastrophe. And other countries, you know, there is a problem in the developed countries, which is the replacement rate of, you know, the number of children that are being born into families. And the United States is, if we did not have immigrants, we would not be a growing population at all. We're right at the stagnation. We're at the bare replacement rate right now in terms of numbers of children being born in families. And immigration is really what has saved us from reaching this tipping point.
It's what saved Europe.
Even more quickly. And for instance, Japan, which is sort of an isolated place, has had a long-term economic stagnation, which is clearly, to some extent, reflected or caused by the fact that they are below the replacement rate in the number of children they're having, and so their population is actually shrinking, hasn't grown for quite a long time. China has the same problem. China's kind of trying to figure out what to deal. You have 1.3 billion people, but when it isn't a growing number of people, it becomes a little bit of an economic problem. And so here we are in the United States fighting immigration, which is actually one of the three alternatives we have for dealing with this tipping point. The tipping point's economic consequences have like only two things you can do about them. One, you can increase the revenue side, increase the amount of money the government takes in so that they can pay out more benefits to these older people, or you can decrease the benefits to those older people, which is draconian in the circumstance that these older people find themselves in. You know, we fooled ourselves with this whole backing off in the private sector, backing off on pensions that are private pensions and letting everyone run their own 401k operations, because first of all, that presumed that people were in businesses and earning enough money to even make a 401k possible, right? I mean, if you're earning a minimum wage, you're not.
There's no
401k. It's paycheck to paycheck. And we can demonstrate now that Americans living in the median household are living paycheck to paycheck. So you can't live paycheck to paycheck and accumulate money in a 401k. So this is a problem that not only exists for the people who are currently aging, but it's a problem that is going to be very dire when the millennials age, you know, when the next big generation moves into retirement, and they have suffered under this new revised America that has a smaller middle class and has less individual savings. So, you know, this is all stuff that the business leaders of this country ought to be looking at, because this is the stuff that breaks up societies.
You know, Sandy, it doesn't matter. Democrat, Republican, none of that matters when you're talking about what we know is coming. We're talking about people who've worked their lives, Sandy. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about people who've gold-bricked. We're not talking about people who haven't tried.
Well, we're talking about people's grandmothers.
Yes.
We're talking about people's grandfathers, but even more grandmothers, because like you pointed out, maybe off the air, you know, men, you know, we can congratulate ourselves. We die early.
Yeah,
And women live on, and so, you know, most of the elderly, and increasing, every year that you count in terms of age-wise, chronologically going out, it becomes more and more women. So that by the time you're at 85, that number of women as compared to men is a big dominant majority, right? The 65% maybe of the people alive at age 85 are women. And so, you know, they're dependent on as are men, but those women, most of them lived at a time when they weren't working for their entire lifetimes, you know, so they were dependent on what could be gathered and saved by the family and Social Security.
So, Sandy, the burden that as these times approach with kind of like warp speed, Generation Xers, Generation Ys, they're the ones who, the majority of the resources in the country are going to be going to deal with this issue.
Well, you know,
or they're going to just be totally ignored. It's got to be one or the other.
Well, it becomes a rock and a hard spot because, you know, those people will have to save for their own retirements, and the burden of taking care of the people who are elderly, who have inadequate means other than what can be supplied by the government, will have to be supplied through taxes on those who are earning money, which will be those younger people who are striving to save money for themselves. So, you know, we're creating a serious rock and a hard spot issue, and that's why we ought to wake up and look at all the different levers we have to change this thing, because, you know, it just has to do with us being on the wrong course.
You know, Sandy, when we talk about all these other things that divide us, right, Democrat, Republican, all of those things. This is something that they should be able to sit down together. I don't care who's the president.
Right.
You know, I don't care who's in charge of Congress, who's in charge of the Senate. They surely know, right? These people who are in the Congress and the Senate know this is a major issue that's before them, right?
Well, and, you know, we were talking on Monday about the sitting in the family planning priorities. In a family, the priority of grandmother and grandfather in the retirement would be one of the top priorities. It's what you have to plan for in your life. And so it would cause us as a family to look much more carefully at the big pots of money that we're spending on things. And what's the biggest pot?
Our military.
What's the biggest pot of money we spend on it, which is the military and our defense budget. And so, you know, grandma is going to be living in destitution, and we're going to be spending huge amounts of money on our defense budget. Now, does that make a lot of sense? And is our defense, does our country face the kind of national risk that would warrant having grandma die in poverty?
You know, Sandy, when you put those two things together, and from the perspective of the way you just presented it, it's an easy answer.
Well, it should at least cause us to put really sharp glasses on to try and figure out how have we decided what kind of danger America faces. How do we reach those conclusions? Because those are the primary conclusions that then drive the notion that we have to spend every dollar that's asked for by the military to meet the requirements they have to meet all of these supposed dangers that we believe exist all around the world. So we can have, you know, hundreds of military bases and the biggest Navy in the world, the biggest Air Force in the world, so we can sustain the cost of fighting three wars on three fronts. You know, all of this stuff is our assumptions we've made about the kind of risk that the world poses to America that prompts us to spend all of our money this way and keep us from having child daycare and investing in our children and investing in grandma.
I mean, this is around the corner, Sandy, right? I mean, this truly is around the corner. And so you add to that, Sandy, the fact that many of the people who are aging have illnesses that are going to cost a lot of money.
Oh yeah,
the cost of medication.
I mean, I didn't cost the medical industry a penny for most of my entire life.
I know.
You know,
yeah, and now
wow,
you know,
cash register is ringing.
But
I'm a medical profit center as far as I can tell.
But that's all of us as we age.
Yeah,
and so you would think that these are things, Sandy, that have priority or should be prioritized in the country. And I know we've got people who don't want to think about getting old, right? Well, I don't want to think about that. Well, you know, whether you think about it or not, it's a blessing to get to be old, right? It truly is.
Oh, yeah.
And so the preparation for it, you know, it can't be, well, those people should have put money away like I did, right? That's not going to be good enough. That's not going to be...
Actually, you know, our generation, most of us lived before the time of the 401k, so that, you know, the older edge of the baby boomers, at least, lots of them have defined benefit plans.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, have had resolved for themselves many of these risks that are now being forced upon everyone younger than us.
So when we get back, Sandy, I remember when they came up with the 401k. And so I want you to walk us through a little bit about, you know, how that came.
Because that's what began to happen.
And so all of that, and
you know, we have, you know, my firm, I have a contractual pension. As long as the firm is doing well, I do real well with the pension I get.
Right.
And it's COLA adjusted. So... Bingo. So,
I know, but
and so is your pension plan.
Yes,
probably.
Yeah, it is. But we're getting to a point where again, it ended with my generation.
Yeah.
And my group. I can go for that. I can name that in one tune. I got it right. I can go for it.
Yeah, you did.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. What's the name of the song? The music show that I've never watched. Never watched any of those.
Yeah, sometimes I need more hints than that. Let's see. The show that you've never watched.
The music thing where they have.
You play a few notes and yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I've never watched it. Anyway, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Sandy, my mind stopped, and so I didn't go any further with that. But anyway. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. Sandy is looking at me in disbelief with what's coming out of my mouth.
Your mind stopped.
Yeah, I know that's
worrisome.
Yeah. But anyway, I wanted to ask you about the 401k.
Yeah.
Because I remember when they came to us and said, "We've got something great coming for you guys." And
this will be your own money.
Yeah. And
you'll have options. You can take it out as a lump sum.
Yeah. And they made it sound, because we were already locked into a pension.
Right.
And so they were saying, you can put your money into this. And so we had guys who, every break, they were running to the phone. They were checking all this money that they had. Because the money was in the stock market, and blue collar guys were all of a sudden getting connected to the stock market.
Well, a couple of things about it. One thing was that all those people who thought they had all that money hadn't really figured out how much money it would take to retire and have, for instance, the 401k replaced what was called defined benefit plans. And a defined benefit plan, you knew what the dollar amount was, the annual salary, essentially, you were going to get through your pension. So you let's say you had earnings of $95,000 before you retired, and you were going to get a pension that was going to be like 60% of that or something. So you were going to get $54,000
right.
a year pension out of that. And furthermore, it was going to be COLA adjusted, so the cost of living adjustment would be made annually. So you knew how much you were going to get. You could kind of figure out, that's how I can live.
For the rest of your life.
It'll be enough, you know? And so what happened, though, was that in order to fund that, the corporations were required to put aside money each year to contribute to the pension fund, and then the pension fund was invested in the stock market and places like that in order to build up this pile of money that was necessary to pay out these defined benefits to all the retired people. And during the time when people were not retiring very rapidly, it was pretty easy to pay this defined pension because more money was coming in the front end of the fund in contributions than was going out the back end, and the companies didn't have to contribute that much money to keep it going. And then when more people started retiring, the actuaries rolled up their sleeves and looked at it a little more carefully and said, wow, you know what? We haven't really been putting aside enough money in the past, and your fund is going to be underfunded to pay out the pensions that you're going to be committed to with this fixed benefit kind of arrangement unless you start contributing a lot more every year into the fund. And the money they contribute into the fund was an expense that came off their earnings. So the businesses began to look at this and think, oh my God, this is going to become a real drain. We got to worry about this. And so they began to come up with options, and one of the options they had was a defined contribution plan where they said, we know how much we're going to contribute every year, and we don't know
know, however, how much that'll pay out at the end. We just know how big the fund will be. And that was really only saleable in the circumstance in which the fund was divided up into pieces so that each individual owned a piece of the fund, so they knew how much they were at least going to have in terms of their pile of money, which could then be converted into use as a pension or however. They could turn it into an annuity, or they could take it out as a pile of money and then use it as a pile of money. And so that's what happened. The 401k was the K Street adjustment. It was created in the tax code, and it became a method for having defined contribution plans. And so most of them were derived from the basis that the business said, we'll contribute money, and you can contribute some money into this pile of money, which is your money. In the end, which made it sound cool, except that in order to get the same kind of defined benefit out of that 401k, it was going to take a big pile of money. And most people really just didn't understand that.
They really sold us on it. And certainly it made us believe you're putting this money away, you're putting this money away, you're putting this money away, and at the end of it, I'm going to have all this money. And it didn't work that way because you had control over where you put the money, and whether it was in Dow Jones, the S&P, or
500. That's how index funds sort of got started in response.
Yeah, but
to
people who don't know anything about any of those things, now all of a sudden you think you know. And
early on, one of the sins of the 401ks was that many of the people put the money into the stock of the company they worked for.
Yeah, we got.
And so when Enron collapsed, actually, many of the Enron employees were badly burned because they had put their 401k money into Enron.
So
A.O. Smith probably did the same thing.
So what we did was we looked at our company. The name of it was Tower Automotive at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We watched all this investment in what they were doing in the infrastructure of the plant. They had spent money bringing in new technology, something A.O. Smith hadn't done in 50 years. And we said, oh, man, we could buy this at $26 a share. And so we took our money and we bought into the company, many of us, because we saw the company investing this money, and we thought nobody else would know, because the only people who can know about the investment in the company is those of us who work here. We're watching this. Listen, we got to go to a break. I know. And I got to talk about it on the other side. I will be right back, and then we'll get into some other things. It's Friday with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.